for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. We build our lives one choice at a time, usually without a great deal of reflection on how these choices over time shape our lives. Social psychologist Sheena Iyengar is an expert on choice. In a new book, she talks about what choice means in our lives and what it takes to become a better chooser. The book is titled The Art of Choosing, and Sheena Iyengar joins me in the studio to talk about why we make the choices we do and the power of choice in our lives. She is a professor of business at Columbia University. Do join us, 800-433-8850. If you choose, send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also send us a message through Facebook, or you can send us a tweet. Good morning to you, Sheena, and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
I think we should make sure that our listeners know that you are a non-sighted person, and therefore it strikes me that you have to make particular choices. Tell us about the fact that you live without sight.
You know, it's funny. When I was writing the book, there were times when I really debated about whether to talk about the fact that I'm blind, because in many ways I thought, well, as a blind person, I don't think I make different choices from anyone else. And yet it seemed like it was such a big part of my life that obviously it should have affected my relationship with choice in some way. And as I thought about it, I realized that it was because I was blind that in some way I was fascinated by choice. You know, growing up, at every step of the way as I was going blind, there were always questions, you know, will she be able to walk to school by herself? And can she study math and science? Can she study in a normal school? Will she be able to shave her legs? You know, the questions were different at every stage of my life, but they always kept coming. And they were always questions that made it salient to me that there are limits to choice. And then the question became, well, is this a limit that I have to accept because it really is a limit? Or are there opportunities here to create new possibilities? And there was always this tension between the limit and do you accept the limit versus do you explore possibilities or create opportunities for yourself? For me, that tension between limit and possibility became salient because I was blind, but I think this is the tension that we all face. It really is one of the key elements to the art of choosing.
How old were you when you began to lose your sight?
My parents first diagnosed it or got it diagnosed when I was about 3 years old. At some point, they got a little suspicious because I kept banging into things, and my parents would regularly say, watch out! And they discovered they were saying that even before I got to the object and actually banged into it, so they clearly picked up on the fact that I wasn't seeing it. And so eventually they took me to the New York Presbyterian Hospital, and they did all these tests and discovered that I had retinitis pigmentosa.
And there was nothing at the time to choose that could have been done.
There's no cure as of right now for retinitis pigmentosa. Normally, when people have retinitis pigmentosa, the onset of it happens later in life, and so you usually lose most of your vision at a much older age. But I had a very rare form of it, and it was it came from genetics, I was born legally blind, and the deterioration happened very quickly.
I see. There's not just the sight factor that comes into this. There's also the cultural factor. you are a Sikh.
Mm-hmm.
And within that community, there are arranged marriages. So culturally speaking, one could argue that your choices were made narrow for you.
That's interesting. Yes, my parents had an arranged marriage. They actually met each other on their wedding day. In fact, my mom said her first words to my dad on their wedding night. And my father couldn't see her face until after the wedding was over because she was put in veils, so he really didn't know what his wife looked like. I grew up in the U.S., so I grew up in the land of opportunity. I grew up in the world that told you you can be whatever you want to be. All you have to do is dream about it and put your mind to it, and of course you can achieve it. And, you know, that was what I was taught in school, but when I was at home, I was going to a very traditional Sikh home. So I was constantly going back and forth between being a Sikh and living in America. And as a Sikh, you are always reminded of your duties and your obligations and following tradition. And so, you know, as a Sikh, you never cut your hair. You respect the wishes and ideas of your elders, your parents, the folks at the temple. And I went to temple on Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday. And I went back and forth between these two worlds where on the one hand, I'm taught about the importance of duty. On the other hand, I'm taught about the importance of preference. And these two worlds meant that you had very different ideas about who would do the choosing and how important it really was for you to do the choosing yourself.
And when you perhaps presented the idea that you'd like to make your own choices, how did your parents react?
Well, I got in trouble quite a few times growing up.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I remember the first time I actually cut my hair. I think it was my freshman year in college, and I went to the beauty salon, and I didn't even get my hair cut very short, but my hair used to be, you know, all the way down to my, you know, I think my hips, maybe even a little bit below my bottom. And I got it, you know, trimmed to about mid-back. And I remember my mother was very, very upset.
But you felt it was important for you to make that choice.
I did, because as an American, I felt that I should get to choose who I am and what I do. But one of the things I've learned over the years is there really is a very different language that you learn as you go back and forth between the two cultures. So, you know, the worst thing I could say to my mom is, you know, Mom, it's my life. You know, that's just the worst insult that you could give your mom in an Asian culture. It's like, what do you mean it's your life? So,
how long did it take her to assess and to come to some understanding that it is your life?
Oh, I don't know if Indian parents ever come to that assessment. They learn to accept what you end up doing and just say, you know, oh, okay, I'll forgive you.
But you see, that's why I'm so fascinated that you've chosen this subject for your book, because you're clearly not just talking about your own life. You're talking about the choices that all of us make as individuals and how those choices take us way, way beyond ourselves.
Oh, absolutely. It was because I was a Sikh and an American that made it salient to me that you go back and forth between considering your duties to others and your personal preferences. But I actually think that every single one of us struggle with that tension in different ways. And that also is part of the art of choosing, is figuring out how you're going to balance that, those two.
But is there actually an art of choosing, or do we simply choose based on what's happening in our lives at that moment without even realizing we're making a choice. I'm talking here about little things, obviously. I mean, each of us makes hundreds of choices in a given day as to which way we'll go, whether we'll stop for that orange light or go through it, whether we'll put out our hand and touch someone. I mean, there are just hundreds of choices each day.
There are, and I think it's because we're constantly making choices every second of our lives that science can never tell us the whole story. Science can help us align the odds for some types of choices, you know, making sure that you pick the better health care or the better way of saving for your retirement, that sort of thing. But much of it is an art, and I often think of the art of choosing as being almost analogous to jazz and improvisation or any kind of art. That, yes, much of it is habitual. Much of it you kind of do as you just go through the motions. But there is that choice factor, those critical moments when you're playing the music and you make these vital choices that really make the difference between whether it's going to be a great piece, a good piece, or a forgettable piece.
Sheena Iyengar, and we're talking about her new book, The Art of Choosing. I look forward to hearing your calls. And here's our first email from Anthony. He says, I spent nearly 3 years training as a Buddhist monk. One of the things that struck me during the training was how the limit of choices during the strict training was liberating. It made me reflect on the fact that growing up in the 80s and 90s in America, there were just too many choices. My parents were happy I had much open to me, but I floundered for years, becoming somewhat of a dilettante until the Buddhist training helped me by limiting the choices I had. The Asian culture I experienced, Korean in this case, seemed much more comfortable with the limit of choices. If American culture has been given too much choice, giving way to our unsustainable consumer culture and apathetic youth, that's my question. What do you think, Sheena?
I think that choice can be beautiful. It's really the tool that enables us to create. But if it's allowed to run wild, if we don't have any direction and it doesn't have any limits, we can become really undirected. And I think what he's talking about here is how that experience in the Buddhist training camp was that it enabled him to focus And even if you look around us today with the barrage of both information and choices that we have on the internet, on our cell phones, on just in every aspect of our life now, you're seeing people struggling to hold on to focus.
So that the number of choices presented to us means that we have to choose or we're going to become confused.
We feel obligated to choose, and that's what makes us confused. If we were able to actually shut things down and just say, you know, look, I'm not going to read my emails or I'm for this much time, or I'm not going to deal with all these options. I'm just going to limit myself. That gives you the opportunity to actually focus.
How much scientific research has been done on how we choose?
There's been about two decades or more, almost three decades now, of work that looks at all the ways in which we make choices, in particular all the ways in which we choose things that many would call irrational, although there's still a debate out as to what's irrational and what's rational.
Talk about some of the different ways we make choices.
What sorts of choices do you have in mind?
Anything, from the foods we eat to the partners we choose to the places we go. How do we make those different kinds of choices?
Well, there's a number of choices we make because we are influenced or manipulated in some way that we don't observe. There's a lot of behind the scenes, shall we say, influences happening on us all the time. And that affects most of our sort of everyday habitual choices, and sometimes even big ones. So, for example, why do most Americans, and actually most people around the globe, love Coke more so than they love Pepsi? And it's not that Pepsi hasn't been trying to challenge Coke. They have been. But there's something about Coke that's really gotten into our psyche. And it turns out it's really gotten into our psyche. And that's because of many, many years of marketing and very well-placed marketing. So, for example, there was a study recently done by Reed Montague, where he took people who were diehard Pepsi and Coke fans and he put them under an MRI machine. And now he squirted either Coke or Pepsi into their mouth, and the same portion of their brain lit up as a function of the sugars that they were drinking. But they actually couldn't tell them apart whether they were drinking Coke or Pepsi. And then what he did was while he was squirting this fluid into their mouths, he showed them a can of either Coke or Pepsi. And now an interesting thing happened. The people that were looking at the can of Coke, regardless of whether they were actually tasting Coke or Pepsi, the happy portion of their brain lit up. And that didn't happen for Pepsi.
Wow.
And, you know, when I saw that, I was like, why? What's so special about Coke? And actually, when you go back and look at all the ways in which Coke has marketed itself, it really has become the symbol of, you know, of America, of freedom, of democracy. It's like mom apple pie and Coke. And, you know, even Santa Claus, the red on the Santa Claus was actually commissioned by a Coca-Cola artist. And so that red is identical
to the Coca-Cola can.
Absolutely.
So what you're saying is when we're making choices of a commercial nature, we are quite likely influenced by outside factors. But what about when we're making personal choices, for example, choosing a mate?
Choosing a mate is actually quite interesting, right? Because it's changed over the years. But let's look at speed dating, for example. It's become very popular, speed dating, online dating. I actually did a number of studies on speed dating a few years ago with my colleague, Ray Fissman and Itamar Simonson. And what we found is if you ask people, you know, what are you looking for in someone you're going to date? You know, the women always say, I want somebody that's funny and I want him to be smart and I want him to be kind. And those are really the most important things to me. And if you ask the guys, well, they almost always say, well, she better be a good looker. And then you bring them into the speed dating event. And you find that, yes, if they see, say, 5, 6, at max 10 dates, then they will actually pick the one that they thought. The women will actually be more likely to say yes to the guys that, you know, they really did think were funny or kind or smart or all three. But when they actually have a lot more than 10, which is the typical case, so even if I double it and give them 20, or and imagine what happens on online marketing, online matching sites, you find that the women forget about it. They just start picking the guys that are good looking.
So
their criteria goes out the window because it's just too tough. It takes too much energy on their brains to figure out who's really funny. And what's the easiest thing to figure out if you've got all these men that are lined up? It's, all right, well, let me see who's the most good looking here.
But go then to the other extreme. Go to those individuals like your mother or like your father who have no choice, who are simply presented with a choice. What does that do to the human brain, to the human psyche, to the human emotion?
Well, one of the things that happens in an arranged match is that you believe that that person that you are being wed to is your destiny. That is your fate. And that could end up being a good fate. It could end up being a neutral fate. It could end up being a bad fate. I mean, you can still end up with someone you don't really want to be with. But that's whether you want to be with them becomes irrelevant. The point is that this is the person that you will be with. And that essentially, once you take away the choice aspect, now they have to really just focus on making the compromises and figuring out how they're going to make it work and hopefully not kill each other in the process.
But isn't that demoralizing to a certain extent? That one, I realize that culturally one grows up accepting that notion right from the start that my marriage will be arranged. But on the other hand, isn't there that sense of resistance or even resentment that I don't have a choice?
No, there's no expectation. I mean, now it's changing in that you would pick amongst a few options that your parents have pre-selected for you. But no, I've seen plenty of happy arranged marriages, happy love marriages, unhappy arranged marriages, unhappy love marriages.
Has anyone ever done a survey of how many divorces are there in arranged marriages versus those where freedom of choice has taken place?
They have. I don't know how helpful they are, just because, you know, because it's destiny, you're not exactly able to divorce this person, and that's really frowned upon. Because one of the things to keep in mind here is these are very different ideas of marriage. You have very different expectations from the marriage and what it'll bring about. So, for example, in an arranged marriage, the idea is that, you know, your parents helped align the odds. So you picked two people based on their resumes and their families, and they should presumably be compatible. And the idea is that over time, they'll develop this sort of affection or love, or what we might call that soul bond, soulmate connection. By contrast, in a love marriage, you start off, you know, this is your soulmate, you know, and this is going to be really meaningful till the day you die. And that's going to happen despite any compatibility differences you might have. And so you come in with very different expectations. Mm-hmm. When you actually do surveys of love marriages and arranged marriages, and they have done some comparisons both between Americans and Indians as well as amongst Indians themselves, those who've had a love marriage versus an arranged marriage, what you find is that on the day of their wedding, love marriages report being happier than arranged marriages. But about 15 years later, when you look at the track, you know, their reported happiness every year, love marriages' happiness is coming down, down, down over the years, whereas the arranged marriage happiness is going up, up, up.
Interesting. Now, moving from the personal to the more global, how closely do these ideas of choice and freedom relate when you're talking about, for example, democracy and exporting democracy to other nations with the idea of offering freedom of choice?
You know, we think, as Americans, we really believe that freedom is something we're born with, understanding what it is, that we were somehow born with the knowledge of what it is, and that we're innately wired to appreciate and value it. And while it's the case that we all appreciate and value having control, so no society says, come conquer me. But our notion of how you practice freedom is very different. I mean, America's very unique in its point and in its place in history. It was the only place that brought together political freedom, economic freedom at the same time, at this unique point in history. And then in the 1800s, we added to that this idea of personal freedom with Emerson's view of self-reliance. Well, so now what we do is we go into places like Iraq or Afghanistan, and clearly nobody wants to be subjugated or fear being killed. But this idea that we would go in and they would naturally welcome our idea of freedom or even understand how you practice it, what its consequences are, is strange.
To say the least.
Yes. I mean, maybe a more concrete way to talk about this. You know, I spent my life, as I mentioned before, I was a Sikh American, and I loved to travel. I was an undergrad. I really thought of myself as somebody who was culturally aware. And when I was a PhD student, I immersed myself in Japanese and went to Japan to do part of my dissertation. And I went to Japan. I was in Kyoto. And in my first week, I was at a restaurant and I ordered a cup of green tea. And the waiter brought me over this cup of green tea. And I asked, you know, can I have a sugar? And then the waiter says, you know, I'm sorry, we don't use sugar in our tea. That's just not done. And I said, I understand that. I understand in Japanese culture, you don't put sugar in your tea. But could I please have some sugar in my tea? It's really tough for me to drink it without sugar. I find it a little bitter. Well, the waiter just sort of stood there, and then, you know, I kept insisting, and then he went over to the manager, and the manager came over, and I had to explain to the manager that I wanted sugar with my tea, and then the manager and the waiter were, like, engaged in this lengthy discussion, at which point I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is all just for some sugar. Finally, the manager comes over and says to me, I'm sorry, we don't have sugar. And so then I order a cup of coffee, and on the saucer next to my coffee cup were two packets of sugar.
Oh, that's so funny.
And, you know, as an American, I'm outraged, right? Because, my God, they're violating my rights as a consumer. I mean, I should have the right to decide how I'm going to drink my tea. And yet, from the Japanese perspective, they were preventing me from engaging in a major faux pas.
That would have not only cross their lines, but other people around you might have seen you put sugar in your tea and you could have caused an uproar in the restaurant, do you think?
Well, or other clientele sure. might have thought that this restaurant is not proper.
Interesting. So you drank your coffee with your sugar, or you could have put that aside and ordered a second cup of green tea and put the sugar into that.
I could have done that. I suppose that would have been a solution. I got the message, though, and I just drank my cup of coffee, and after that, I always stuck to the green tea the way they wanted me to drink it.
Sheena Iyengar, she is professor of business at Columbia University. Her new book is titled The Art of Choosing. When we come back, we'll open the phones. I would love to hear all about your choices. Call us on 800-433-8850.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org, by the Avis Family Foundation, supporting expanded foreign news online and on air, and by PBS, presenting The National Parks, America's Best Idea, from filmmaker Ken Burns, airing tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. This is NPR.
Ricky Gervais, the creator of the original BBC series The Office and the HBO series Extras, is known for his odd but hilarious humor.
I'd rather do stuff that makes a big connection with a few people than a small connection with loads.
We'll talk with Ricky Gervais on The Next Fresh Air. He has a new HBO animated series. Join us.
And it's time to open the phones if you've just joined us. We're talking about a new book. It's titled The Art of Choosing. Sheena Iyengar is a professor of business at Columbia University. She holds an undergraduate degree from the Wharton School of Business and a doctorate in social psychology from Stanford University. On the cover of the book is a beautiful red apple and a bright orange. And one would assume immediately that I, looking at this book, would choose one or the other. Now, the question is, what's going on in my mind, Sheena, as I make that choice between an apple and an orange? Why is that an art, and how does that affect my outlook on life?
Choice is interesting because it's You know, in order to know which one I want between the apple and the orange, I have to know what they are. I have to know how I feel about each of them. I have to know the pros and cons of each of them. And only then can I choose. Now, well, for most of us, because we've been looking at that apple and that orange for so long and have been considering them and eating them at various stages of our life, we've already done all that process subconsciously so that it can be an instantaneous decision. We can automatically know, yeah, I prefer apples to oranges. But not all decisions are quite that simple.
Exactly.
And that brings you to the phrase apples and oranges,
right,
that are incomparable, which is the other part of choosing.
Let's open the phones. We'll go to University Heights, Ohio. Good morning, Juliana. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was my ears pricked up when I heard her mention the art of choice, because I actually think art is choosing. I'm a retired musician and an artist, and I just had a conversation the other day with somebody that said, "I said the satisfaction of art is you're in a constant state of decision making. When you draw a bow across a string or you're throwing a pot, you're making a judgment and then acting on it." And I think one of the values of art education for children is exactly that, that they get to act on their decisions, which makes it different, I think, from other aspects of education.
That's a great point, Sheena.
Yes. I mean, what's great about teaching kids music and art, they really see the consequences of each choice that they make as they're making them, and that's a great learning tool. I mean, you have to learn how to make choice. We think it comes innately, but in fact, we're learning how to do it throughout our lives.
Thanks for calling, Juliana. Let's go to Orlando, Florida. Hi, Diane. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. And she just said something that really led right into what I was going to call, what I am calling about, and that is, you know, people being able to make choices. I'll use myself, but I've already gotten lots of help. But there are people who we are not allowed really to have choices as we're growing up, and then we continue to act with those same precepts in our adult life, trying to, I would say, please outwardly and never really looking inwardly, you know, so we just sort of randomly fall into things. But now in my 60s, I finally have got it or am learning it. So I just wanted to ask you if you could address that, and also, is it in your book about how to continue to develop that, I'll say, muscle, you know, that part of our brain about how to know that we're really making a choice that we want to make, that we want, without just thinking, well, what does somebody else want? And it's easy to, you know, it's easy to say, well, you know, you don't ask what somebody else wants. It's very difficult to change a lifelong pattern.
That's a great question. So, you know, as I mentioned before with the Coke and Pepsi example, so many of our choices are influenced many times subconsciously, you know, by marketers. Many times by the people around us, we get influenced by what their preferences are, or we make choices to help them out, or the kinds of choices they want us to make. And, you know, if we were to think of ourselves as 100% independent, we'd probably go crazy. We can't become completely devoid of all influences. We can't become these asocial beings. And so the only way to really manage it, and I do talk about this in the book, is to come up with what's your priorities. And you can't make that list very long, because our brains really can't handle more than, well, I even talk about this in my book, to more than 7 ± 2 things at any one time. So I would actually, for your priorities, make them more like 5. And once you know your priorities, that gives you the domains in which you will focus. What that allows is for you to not only make choices, but it also makes you more able to dedicate your resources to trying to figure out, are they trying to manipulate me? Can I make an informed choice? Let me do my homework as to what it is I really want. Because in the end, the power of choosing comes less from the ability of acting independently It comes more from the ability of vetoing the external influences that you don't want.
Do you think that as we get older, we make better choices?
As we get older, we are better informed about what we like and don't like and what our priorities are. And that helps us make better choices. But at the same time, our ability to deal with lots and lots of information becomes tougher. We can't keep track of as many things in our memory bank. And that's another reason why it becomes really, really critical for that person to pay attention to what is their goal, what is the most important thing. That way they can narrow that information and only focus on that which is necessary to their goal, as opposed to getting potentially distracted.
Could May I just ask a quick question?
Sure.
Please.
Because I love what you're saying, and I am going to get your book.
Oh, well, thank you.
However, my question is, when you talk about people setting their priorities and their goals and what have you, I find that I'm not alone. There are many of us that sort of, I'll say, flip-flop through life, not based on our own goals and priorities, and even finally at this stage, trying to discern priorities and interests and goals is very difficult. Because it's always like, well, do I trust my own thinking, or am I letting someone else influence me, or do I even really know myself? So I'm really still working on that, too, and I wondered if that part is in your book as well.
So we often try to look inside us, and I would read chapter 3 of my book to get some thoughts on this question, but we often have this tendency to try to look inside us, to try to find who we really are. Right? It's like we're trying to unearth that sculpture inside. And the reality is who we are is the sum of all the choices we have made. So that if you want to know what your priorities are, what your goals are, it involves looking at yourself more from the observer perspective than from the insider perspective. It's looking at, well, what are the choices I've made? Given those choices, what direction do I want to head in?
First, you've got to understand where you are now and why you've arrived there because of the choices you've made. And then to make additional choices going forward, which could take you in a totally different direction.
That was much better said than I could ever say.
Oh, no. No. Good luck to you, Diane. Let's go to Liz in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air.
Good morning. I would like to know, in a society where most of our decisions are made in groups of people, in the government, in business corporations, how group decision-making works, especially with people who come from different ethical backgrounds and faith backgrounds?
Well, it's much tougher when you have a group of people that are all very different from one another. There's no doubt that even though we often talk about the importance of having more diverse groups make a decision, it becomes harder. The trade-off is that if you have a bunch of people that all have the same ideas, they make decisions much more quickly because they come to consensus faster. If you have a group of people that bring to the table very different ideas, they are more creative. They also have more quarrels. They have more interpersonal conflict. And so the job of the mediator or the leader becomes, well, how do I make sure that I surface all these ideas and take them in a constructive direction and don't allow this group to disintegrate into a dysfunctional conflict?
Interesting, because in a workplace, for example, surely you've got very diverse thinking modes, problem-solving modes, backgrounds. So what you're saying is it's up to the leader to somehow find a way to create a whole out of those many different parts.
To create a truly phenomenal choice that will work. And that's actually what Barack Obama's challenge is right now. If you think about the Republicans and the Democrats, and in terms of the healthcare debate, what they're really arguing about at its essence is the different views they have about freedom. That on the one hand, the Democrats are saying, the only freedom that's fair, the only freedom that I value is one that gives everybody the same outcomes, the same health care. The Republicans are saying, the only freedom that's fair, the only freedom that I value is one that ensures equal opportunity, not equal outcome. So that means that anybody who's worthy or who has more money or who has better health, and whatever the criteria is for greater merit, the people that are more meritorious should get better health care and the people that are less should get less. And neither position is particularly right or wrong, but they are so fundamental to the two parties' different views that Barack Obama's got this major challenge on his hand as to how is he going to come up with a health care option that will speak to both models such that both people believing in either one of those models will believe in the choice that he's providing.
Sheena, you put it well, and what a problem. What a problem. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Patricia in Mount Airy, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Go right ahead, please.
Oh, good morning. My point is, my point is about cause and effect and the consequences of one's choices and taking it to the spectrum of conscious or subconscious or unconscious choice. Example. I am a learn it the hard way kind of gal up in my 60s as an artist and an educator, and I've been working with a group of students that are at that point in their life where depression overcomes them, and some have made the choice to check out, meaning they've been successful about taking their own life. A couple haven't been successful. I don't know if we ever have the conversation about some of the consequences of those extreme choices, much less if you're picking Coke and Pepsi, but let's go to those other ones that are like impulse, but they have extreme long-range consequences. And the other thing is people say, well, I didn't choose. Often by not choosing, you still have made a choice.
Indeed.
That's a great point you've raised, which is the consequences. And this is why I keep saying that you need to know your priorities, because there's so many choices out there. And most of those choices are probably not that relevant to you. I mean, does it really matter to you if you're manipulated into buying Coke versus Pepsi? I mean, after all, if you like it better, what difference does it make? And what you need to really focus in on are the really important things in life, whether they be your particular relationships with your spouse or your children or your friends, or whether it be your work-related decisions. I mean, whatever it is that's really important, you need to be able to have all the emotional and mental resources dedicated to choosing well in those areas, because choosing is not an easy thing.
I think she's also talking about the effects on others of the choices that we make. For example, how a suicide of a young person would affect those left behind.
Ah, yes. So I do think that one of the things that has been lost in the need, in the focus on individual choice, is we become less aware of the consequences that our choice makes on others and has on others. I recently, one of my husband's colleague who had two small children and a housewife, he committed suicide.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Which meant that no life insurance was going to come to the kids. And so now the wife is trying to figure out how she's going to raise the kids. And you, when you see that, you think to yourself, my God, this person was really only focused on his own depression, and in his depression had lost sight of the consequences that such a decision would really have.
This whole question of choosing is, in those last words, so important, because the choices we make affect so many other people. Sheena Iyengar, her new book is titled The Art of Choosing. She's professor of business at Columbia University. Thank you so much for being here. And I want to let listeners know I'm going to Little Rock, Arkansas to KUAR tomorrow and Friday. I'll be back with you on Monday. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.